In which case, I would expect, more of the same, but perhaps some additional nasty surprises, including, a fully blown wealth tax, which I think, based on the experience of every other country, would be a disaster.
It'd also take some time to introduce it. It wouldn't help her this year or next year, maybe not even the year after. Well, just final point to you, that these are difficult times for politicians to manage your economy in a way that pleases the electorate. I mean, we're talking about how these growth figures are pretty miserable and the rise in living standards, they're rising again, but it's over 5 years what at one stage we might have hoped in 1 or 2 years. But we're not alone. I look at the French growth forecasts, the German forecasts, the Italian forecasts. Only America has buoyant growth. There's something about the Western economies at the moment that are a bit grim.
Yeah, and take out tech and IT from America, and you get a similar pattern to the ones you've described in France, Germany, Britain, and Italy. And of course, tech's so strong in America, that's probably unfair to do it. It's worth pointing it out that the underlying non-tech economy isn't doing great there either. Look, you're right. I mean, actually, Britain is within the European kind of cluster doing slightly better actually than most. And playing this tech card again, it could
Okay.
do even more.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you there because we've run out of time, but it's good to finish on an optimistic note. That's it for me today. I'll be back on Times Radio tomorrow. Don't go away. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Andrew, back with The Times at 1 on Wednesday. Good afternoon, 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until 4.
And in the next 2 hours, as fighting in the Middle East increases, we will bring you the latest from a correspondent live from Dubai. We're also going to talk to a former general about the consequences of regime change without a plan. Growth for the next year is downgraded. We'll hear from small businesses and personal finance experts on the Chancellor's spring statement. 100 days out from the World Cup. Is your wall chart up yet? Vassos Alexander will bring us the sport. And after 3:30, our big guest is Nancy Birtwistle, who will explain how to get a cleaner, greener home.
Here's the news at 2, Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Chancellor has been giving an update on the economy in her spring statement, saying the government has restored stability. The OBR has downgraded GDP growth forecasts for this year from 1.4% to 1.1%, while inflation and government borrowing are also expected to be lower than previously thought. Rachel Reeves told the Commons her plan was even more important given global uncertainty.
Stability is the single most important precondition for economic growth. Yeah. That is why we have committed to a single major fiscal event a year, limiting major policy changes to the budget and giving businesses and households the certainty that they need. Today, the new forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility show that our plan is the right one.
Britain is planning to send a warship to Cyprus to defend RAF Akrotiri from Iranian attacks. That's according to three sources talking to The Times. John Healey, the Defence Secretary, had a meeting this morning with senior military figures in which they discussed sending HMS Duncan to the region. Donald Trump earlier told The Sun Keir Starmer has not been helpful on Iran. US President says the special relationship is not like it used to be after a delay in allowing the Americans to use British bases. But speaking with Times Radio, the former Foreign Secretary and Conservative leader William Hague, defended Starmer's approach.
Broadly, the government has reacted in the right way. Trump has not been clear on his objectives. It's not clear what the aim of the war is. So I think it was right to withhold the use of British bases and also right then to allow them to be used for defensive operations.
Israel says it attacked the most important and central command center in Iran during strikes on Tehran last night. It says numerous munitions were dropped on the presidential office and the building that houses the Supreme National Security Council. Meanwhile, Iran has threatened to fire on any ships attempting to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, an important route for moving oil. With missiles being fired and intercepted in the skies over the Middle East, much of the region's airspace has been closed. Some flights have been able to leave the UAE now, but thousands of British people are still stranded. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, says 130,000 have registered with her department. Elsewhere, the Green Party has leapfrogged Labour and the Conservatives into second place in the polls behind Reform UK. A YouGov survey for The Times puts the Greens on 21%, with Reform on 23%. Both Labour and the Conservatives are on 16%. Patrick English is from the pollsters YouGov.
The system is certainly changing. Whether or not the Labour and the Conservatives can recover, I think it's a long way back from here, but never say never in British politics. And this is the reality now of politics in 2026, and has been for some time, is that there are many parties fighting for many seats across many areas of the country.
For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Your favourite centrist grannies are in the house. We're here until 4 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. Hope you're fitting well this afternoon. The WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. So on the programme today, the spring statement has sprung headlights. That got people going only a couple of weeks ago. We're told now they are getting intelligent. What does that mean? We'll talk to Greg Karlstrom of The Economist, who'll join us from Dubai. We're asking whether or not Britain will send a warship to Cyprus. And in health news, our weekly appointment with Dr. Rachel Ward. Is your healthy, expensive muesli actually doing you no good at all? And it's 100 days until the Men's World Cup. Can Iran realistically take part? How on earth will the Men's World Cup be affected by everything going on in the world right now? Vassos Alexander joining us at around 3:15. And our big guest after 3:30 is...
Oh, well, as well as being geopolitically across things this afternoon, we're domestically aligned today.
That's us, isn't it?
It is very much us. And what more could you expect between the hours of 2 and 4? Nancy Birtwistle is going to join us, Sunday Times bestselling author. She is the Queen of Green. So in her 70s, I think this may be the seventh book that she's published, and her shtick is that you can clean your house and make it fragrant and fine without using any chemicals at all. She's got a huge following for her very, very sensible ingredients. Things like ivy she uses, an awful lot of baking soda. There's nothing that you can't do with her pure magic gloop. Mm-hmm. That's what she says. And her latest book is called Essential New Tricks for a Sparkling Green Home. And she will be joining us after 3:30. She won Bake Off, didn't she, in her 60s? There hasn't been a decade in Nancy Birtwistle's life where she hasn't done something and conquered it. In her 30s, she took a dog to Crufts. Not many people can say that, Jane.
But they can't. I mean, did it triumph?
I don't know. Oh. I've put it in kind of number 17 in the question list.
Right. Well, I hope we do find the time to get on to that.
So do I.
I'm always slightly intrigued by that. If you have shown a dog at Crufts, or indeed shown a cat at one of those fantastic cat shows that people really do love. David Baddiel was talking about them, wasn't he, with us not that long ago. And we'd love to hear about your triumphant pets. 0333 003 2353. But of course there is a lot going on in the world. We'll start with the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon.
In at number three, prepare for chaos unleashed by Ayatollah's fall. The former Foreign Secretary William Hague says the death of the Iranian dictator is undeniably positive, but he warns that Trump's gamble is pushing the world into an uncertain future. The second most read story, ex-Royal Navy commander faces court-martial over New Zealand ship sinking. This is Commander Yvonne Gray, who denies charges over the loss of a Navy ship which hit a reef and sank near Samoa in 2024. The most read piece on the Times website, something that we're going to cover in depth after 3 o'clock, UK set to send warship to Cyprus after drone attack. The Times' live page has all the latest updates on the conflict in the Middle East, including the expected deployment of HMS Duncan. You can read all of those stories on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe and then you never miss a moment.
Now, let's go to the Commons. And Rachel Reeves has trumpeted growing defence spending and higher wages in what was widely regarded, let's be honest, as a policy-free spring statement. The Chancellor said growth would be lower this year than had been predicted, but it would then increase.
Average growth across the forecast period is largely unchanged. While the OBR has adjusted the profile of GDP so that it grows slightly slower in 2026 and then faster in both 2027 and 2028. So GDP is forecast to grow by 1.1% in 2026, 1.6% in both 2027 and 2028, and 1.5% in both 2029 and 2030.
The Chancellor, who says her plan is the right one for Britain. But of course, there are fears it all could be undermined if inflation or financial instability increase because of the problems in the Middle East. Let's go to Tina McKenzie, the policy chief of the Federation of Small Businesses. Tina, good afternoon to you. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm good, thank you.
Now, I know that you represent the Federation of Small Businesses, but you are a business person yourself. What is it you do?
I run a recruitment company and a property company.
Right. And how would you describe how you're doing in either or both of those businesses right now?
Well, when you're running a recruitment company, you can really see across many different sectors and many different types of businesses how they're feeling. And it's really tough out there, especially for hospitality, retail. They're really struggling and they know they're about to get a cost stack coming on the 1st of April as well. And that's all in the kind of context of now we probably are going to see a huge hike in energy costs for businesses as well. And small businesses across the country are just not protected. So I think you've got two kind of stories. Big business seems to be doing well. You know, your big banks are posting multi-million pound profits and, you know, the big utilities and things. But the small businesses of the UK, which is 99% of all businesses, are struggling, and our surveys tell us that.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to say that Rachel Reeves, as Chancellor, she can't really catch a break, can she? She's giving this spring statement today, but everybody's mind is focused on the Middle East, and all the predictions, all the positivity could be just hurled to one side because of events over which she realistically has absolutely no control. Do you have sympathy?
Well, I think she's no control over what's about to hit us in terms of energy costs and any other kind of hits in terms of trade. But she does have control over a lot of other things. So, for example, kind of this spring statement, she did say that there wouldn't be many kind of revelations in it, but there was nothing really in it. So for all those businesses that are really struggling, that are about to get increases in labour costs, energy costs, and also, you know, we know that we're having further increases with statutory sick pay. And she also knows, because I've spoken to her about this, she also knows that they're really hurting, and she could do something about it. Not everything's financial either, but she can get in and actually start to support them in terms of regulation, the costs around even dealing with HMRC, Making Tax Digital's coming along now. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of things that are hitting them that they probably just don't need to be doing right now to the small businesses that are struggling. And if you remember, our economy is made up of 5.7 million businesses. Only 8,000 of those are actually the big businesses. And all too often we speak about big business and we talk and focus on them. And really up and down the high streets, you walk up and down your own high street, they're all struggling. So she has a responsibility, irrespective of what's going on, to listen and to take action where needed. Because this downgrade in the economic growth, you know, we don't want that to be a continuation. And she's got to really get in and do something to support those businesses.
Well, yeah, I mean, in fairness, we do know that growth will increase. It's going to go up, apparently, in 27 and 28. But that, I guess, is quite a big if.
Well, it's
now a big if, isn't it? It's a bigger if than it was 2 days ago or 3 days ago.
And, you know, you've got the context of what's going on internationally, and that's out with her control for sure. But there are many things that are within her control. So we've just done this hike on business rates. You know, energy costs is a good one. I hope they're getting prepared to get some protection in here, not just for the big businesses or the high energy users, because small, medium-sized businesses are kind of akin to consumers, and yet they don't have the protections that the government put in for the consumers in terms of negotiating energy contracts and things like that. So there's plenty of things they could do to get in and protect those smaller businesses that, in fact, if they go to the wall, then the economy goes to the wall, because we know they hire more people in the private sector and we know they give more GDP than the big businesses. So she's got to protect them and she's got to take action.
Now, the Chancellor did also talk quite a bit, actually, about wages going up, which is obviously terrific if you're a worker who's had a pay rise. But I guess, well, clearly there are implications for employers here, big ones.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, minimum wages are going up on the first, and the cost of hiring somebody on top of what you're paying them is going up as well. And we also know that the government had this determination to equalise and bring up the young people's minimum wage. And, you know, most employers are very happy to pay the going rate and to get good talent. But when the government starts to stack on taxes on top of that, that's when it becomes difficult, because essentially you're taking it out of workers' pockets and you're taking it out of the businesses' pockets, and you're sitting with it in the middle as a surplus. Well, that's all wonderful, but what is a surplus for? You know, to give you a better rating? Well, actually, if it's more money that could be paid to people in their pockets, or more money the businesses could invest, well, in the long run, that's better for the economy. And these are all the decisions she has to make.
The Chancellor also attacked both the Tories and Reform. Let's have a listen.
Make no mistake, the Tory Tribute Act up there, they would do exactly the same thing. They may have changed the colour of their rosettes, but the British people won't forget that they are the exact same people who wrecked our public services and wrecked our public finances in the Tory government. The same people, the same policies, and the same disastrous outcomes for working people.
It has to be said that, verbally, Rachel Reeves had quite a bit of pep in her step today. She looked, I mean, she has cut it sometimes, a slightly anxious-looking figure, but I didn't pick up that vibe from her today. And no. I just wonder, Tina, whether you think that attacks like that get through. Do you meet a lot of reform-curious business people in your part of the world?
I mean, we're non-partisan, so we engage with all the parties. Our membership is so huge that the small businesses up and down the country, the membership goes right across all political
yeah,
parties.
Yeah, but I'm just asking, do you meet people who are saying, you know what, I do want Nigel Farage to run Britain?
Of course. Yeah, I mean, I attended the Reform Conference and met many small business owners there. And there were lots of people there and, you know, kind of a lot of people that you might not expect to be there. You know, you're just your regular kind of Middle Britain person type of thing. You know, it wasn't what we're kind of led to believe sometimes in the press. And equally, I go to the Labour conference and again, you know, huge numbers there, and the Tory conference as well. So you get a mixture of people at all of these conferences. But I think ultimately, people want to see change, and in their own lives, even irrespective of what's going on around the globe, if in your own life you're struggling to build a business, a family business you've had for years, decades, you've given so much back to your community, you've always hired young people, you've given people a chance, you're more likely to hire those people that are furthest away from the labour market, you're more likely to help people deliver things off to the old person who can't get to your shop. They give so much to their communities. You're more likely to sponsor the local football club, the local Girl Guides club. They're giving all the time. And I think sometimes they feel like that they're not heard, that the pain that they're suffering, that they're not bringing money home to their own houses because of the cost of employing people. And then they start to think, what's the point? I'm putting everything I have into these businesses, and every which way I turn, from dividend tax to taxes on staff to taxes on everything, is just going up and up and up, and they don't see a way out. So you can see how people get a bit frustrated. But I will say that, you know, for the Chancellor, she is someone that we can pick up the phone to, that we can talk to. She is a listener, and I've had previous Chancellors who did not listen. So she does listen, but she's not in complete control of her party. She's not in complete control of all those departments. One thing they really could get smarter about is procurement. You know, at the moment they're spending billions of pounds. Well, why not spend some of that billions of pounds with your homegrown SME British companies up and down the country? Let's get more of it into those businesses and help those businesses scale.
Thank you very much, Tina. Tina McKenzie of the Federation of Small Businesses. Abigail Foster is a personal finance expert and commentator. Hi, Abigail.
Hello, how are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. Now, were you cheered by what the Chancellor had to say today?
No. I think there was barely anything in it. I understand that obviously it must be incredibly frustrating to have written this over the last few weeks and for it to all basically become a bit obsolete over the weekend, but I do think there could have been a bit more. I think downgrading it from a statement to a forecast and having it on a Tuesday.
Ooh, bit of a wonky line. I wonder if we could make
Abigail, underreported as well.
Abigail, I wonder if we could just take a minute, Abigail, and perhaps we could just call you back. Might even be able to do it on the phone, because we want to hear what Abigail's got to say, but couldn't make too much out of that. Mike says, spring statement. Wouldn't any sensible person just have postponed this statement because of the situation in Iran?
It's just inevitable that growth is going to go down again. And Paul says, I got the impression from that statement today that Rachel Reeves was mainly going through her achievements since 2024. Perhaps she's thinking that she might not be Chancellor come the autumn, says Paul, who's got a suspicious mind. Yes. Or may just be onto something. Who
but
knows?
I think quite a few people are trying to say the same thing at the moment too. I just want to draw your attention to one of the items that we're going to do in a couple of moments' time, just in case you've got thoughts about it, because the last time we tackled the subject of difficult, dazzling headlights, I know that many of you wanted to get involved. And there's a story that you can read in the Times today about Audi and their new cars. I think their EVs have got these extraordinary digital, clever headlights, which are going to be able to throw forward onto the road in front of you symbols that are meant to then help your driving. So if the temperature dips below freezing, they can throw snowflakes out in front. They can also alert you if there is an accident coming up. But loads of people are saying, where's the evidence that drivers aren't going to be distracted by this? And where's the evidence that that somehow is going to be more informative than the stuff that comes up on your dashboard anyway? So you're going to have a dashboard to look at. You might then have a digital screen, and then you're going to have headlights doing something on the road. Have people just got a little bit too ahead of themselves, Jane?
I think there's a strong possibility.
I think there is a strong possibility.
You might be right.
And I think my intonation told you that was the direction of travel. If you've got thoughts about this, though, we know that you love this subject, then do just ping us a quick WhatsApp. It's 0333 003 2353. Jane and I both very much enjoy our driving, but we're not really petrol heads. So if that's you out there and you think that this is the right thing to do, then we would love to inject that into our conversation. Yeah. Back with you, Personal Finance.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed. I am thinking of having a spoiler fitted to the back of the old Mini. I think I'll give it a whirl. Let's rejoin Abigail Foster, personal finance expert and commentator. Actually, Abigail, if you don't mind, I wonder if you could just chat a little bit about student finance. I think quite a few people were expecting that this would feature today, and it just didn't.
Yeah, I was one of them. As a first-year Plan 2 student, I am one of the people that's got over £50,000 worth of debt, finished with a lot less than that. And I was hoping that we'd hear something. I'd hoping that we'd hear some sort of reform to the rate of interest or the repayments, like percentage that we're paying. I think there could have been something, but I felt like a lot of this, I understand why, because obviously they downgraded it from a statement to a forecast, and it was very much just a kind of a readout of the OBR forecast. But I think, you know, the student loan could have definitely come up.
Yeah.
We could have seen more.
So I don't think you're alone at all in thinking that. Are you going to keep the pressure up for change? Because I must admit, I assumed change was very much coming.
Yeah, of course. Well, definitely. There's lots of us that are talking about this right now. And I think that it's really important that something is done. So I think that we should see some sort of like backdated reform. I think obviously the bare minimum is just to unfreeze the threshold at which you start repaying. It was frozen, creating like a fiscal drag problem for students. So hopefully that will be a bare minimum that we'll see. You never know, there might be some reform between now and the budget to student loans, because obviously if they can retrospectively change student loans anyway, why can't they change it between budget and statement? But yeah, I think obviously today's spring forecast was about growth and inflation, but obviously all of these, as you guys have already touched on, kind of are very much in the background, given that we now have the crisis going on in the Middle East. So is any of it really relevant anymore?
Well, let's just briefly mention that, if you don't mind. I mean, anyone who's lucky enough to have a bit of money tucked away, they are going to be concerned now that a crash is coming sooner rather than later.
It's so difficult. There's no crystal ball. Obviously, we all hope that this crisis in the Middle East, you know, goes as quickly as it came, and that actually we won't see huge knock-on impacts. But everyone needs to be aware that their pensions are investments, and that investments are, you know, most of our pensions are invested in like global tracker funds, which tracks the globe. And so when we see changes like sector changes, so obviously the energy sector will increase, the defence sectors will increase, but also other sectors that you might be heavily invested in might drop. You are going to see, obviously, oil prices rise, which has inflationary impacts and then can also impact investments as business costs rise. So, yeah, I think it's something for people to be very cautious of and aware of. But hopefully the ramifications, obviously, of it leading to a recession don't happen. But obviously, I can't say, because obviously I don't have a crystal ball. I wish I did.
Appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed for bearing with us. That's the personal finance commentator, Abigail Foster.
That takes us to 22 minutes past two. Coming up, it's not just super bright headlights. New cars could start projecting images onto the road. That's where we'll go next. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we've been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Download the Free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Transform your kitchen or bathroom. Wix has everything you need, plus all the finishing touches, from beautiful tiles and flooring to a wide choice in paint and lighting. Whatever you're planning, create the perfect space with Wix.
There are fears that the carmaker Audi is blurring the line between safety and spectacle with new intelligent headlights. Glowing symbols like snowflakes and warning triangles will be projected onto the road from the car, with the manufacturer saying that the high-tech invention will improve road safety. But campaigners say it risks distracting drivers. Let's talk to Senior Policy Officer at the RAC, Rod Dennis. Hello, Rod.
Hi there, afternoon.
Would you say it's a help or a hindrance?
Well, I think used in the right way, this technology can be a help. But I think the way it's done, I think, is really important. I think I also think that sort of drivers and the public need to be kind of sort of brought along as we sort of see these kind of technologies roll out. We know how much of a problem dazzling headlights are for drivers. We've done work on this for years here at the RAC. You know, a good majority of drivers told us they felt the problem's getting worse over the last 12 months, not better. So I think with this sort of technology, which is, you know, very advanced compared to what mostly we see on the roads these days, we have to make sure that drivers are aware of these sorts of things, and the general public are as well. We don't want more distracting lights on the road. It should all be focused on improving safety for everybody.
I think the thing that puzzles me about this, Rod, I can understand if you're the owner of the Audi, you might take it for a test drive, you know, fall in love with that particular gadgety part of it, really understand what it is that the car's going to do. But, you know, if I'm next to you on a dual carriageway, or it's a dark night and I'm driving my Skoda Monte Carlo, don't be too jealous, everybody.
Very nice car.
I'm not going to be, I'm going to be quite surprised by things happening and emanating from somebody else's car. So it's not just distracting that driver, it's distracting all drivers, isn't it?
I agree with you. I think there's a cumulative effect here. And I think this idea of sort of more sort of, you know, beams, lights on the road coming from vehicles, add all that together. Imagine a world in, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years time where we've got lots, most cars perhaps on the road doing this. What does the road then look like? It might be fine on an open road when you're driving there by yourself. But as you say, we've got to think about other road users as well. And I'd include cyclists and pedestrians in that too. Look, you know, we should be considering the safety of those groups as part of these technologies too. I think, you know, looking at it from the vehicle manufacturer's perspective, this is about, you know, creating points of difference, you know, things that are going to appeal to drivers that might make them choose one vehicle model over the other. But safety has to come first. You know, I'd make the point, you know, Audi can't just get this sort of stuff signed off, you know, this has to pass all the relevant regulations. But I think we do have to look very, very carefully at this. And as I say, you know, I think it's that cumulative impact of more and more cars potentially in the future having this kind of technology. What does that mean for us as drivers? Is that going to make the roads safer, or is it going to make it less safe if there are lots and lots of vehicles with projections coming out left, right and centre?
How did cars pass those exact regulations that you talk about with regard to the dazzling headlights?
Well, really, the actual regulations that we've got that govern those sorts of lights haven't been updated for an awfully long time. They come out from the United Nations. There's a working group looking at the project, the topic of glare at the moment, I'm pleased to say. But frankly, the regulations themselves date from the days when we had halogen lights, you know, the yellower lights, which people don't seem to be nearly as concerned about compared to the whiter lights we've got in headlights now. So you know, again, from a manufacturer's perspective, they will have passed all the relevant regulations. I think what's happened is that lighting technology has moved on at such a pace and is now being used in all sorts of ways, not just in vehicles, but in other sort of walks of life as well, that arguably regulations haven't kind of kept abreast of that. I think that's the situation we're in now, is that we need the regulations to look at what we've got today and what we might have in the future in terms of other vehicle lights and say, what is acceptable and what's not.
Sure. I'm interested, there's a working group at the UN. Does that speed things up or slow things down, though, Rod?
Well, I get lots of people asking me about when is the problem of headlight glare going to go away, and I'm always very careful when I answer that question. We are in it for the long haul, I have to say, but it is fantastic news that we do have that group. There's been previous groups that have existed at the UN that have sort of petered out without any real decisions being made. That's not the case now. There is a proper international effort. The UK is part of it. Canada, Germany, India, other countries are all reporting the same problems as drivers here in the UK are reporting. And for the first time, we have a kind of group that meets several times a year to try to look for solutions. We are very supportive of that. I would be guarded and say I don't think we're going to see instant improvements, but it should in time reduce the problem of glare that people are experiencing today in future vehicle models. But clearly that's not enough. And that's the reason why here at the RAC, we've told the government they should also look at the existing vehicles on the road here in the UK and what could be done to improve the problem that the drivers already experience with those.
Right. We did put a call out to our listeners this afternoon, Rod, for their experiences. This comes in from Jonathan, who says, yesterday in bright sunlight and whilst wearing polarised sunglasses, I was blinded by the rear brake cluster on an electric car. I've never seen anything so ridiculous. It was maybe 1.5 metres across. And he's right, isn't he? The actual kind of format of where the lights are seems to have changed. And
yes, that's changing rapidly. Look, we've got lots of manufacturers now bringing out vehicles that have the kind of, you know, the vehicle mark, the badge lit up now as well. As I say, the technology is moving on at a pace. And I suppose, you know, from a designer's perspective, I suppose, the fact you've got LEDs and you can arrange them in all sorts of clever ways in vehicles rather than just a bulb, which we had previously. Now, designers can do all sorts of clever things with lights and put them in all sorts of interesting positions. But as I say, that I have to keep coming back to the safety element of this. And at what point, perhaps, you know, basically, we've got enough light going out there now. How about just sufficient light? I think just putting out maximum light on the road to dazzle everyone isn't necessarily the smartest way of harnessing, you know, a very great technology like LEDs. Yeah. We need to use it in the right way.
That's I would completely agree with that. You know, let's just stop. We've got enough light. A quick point from Nick, who says, I'm lucky enough to drive a Tesla, but it does have its challenges. All the information on a single screen results in a focus on the inside of the car rather than the outside. The majority of people do not have the aptitude to be a fighter pilot, so information needs to be simple, easily digestible, and allowing a focus to remain on the road. I love that point, because it is true, isn't it? We are being encouraged to look so much more at the dashboard and the digital screen than actually have the all-sensory perception of driving.
I completely agree with that. Look, there are lots of things that in older vehicles would have been very simple. You switch this dial, you hit this switch, and suddenly you've performed whatever action you need to do, whether it's changing the radio station or putting the heating up or down or whatever. Now, to have to go through a series of menus to do what used to be very, very straightforward actions, I think is a bone of contention, a frustration for many drivers. And I think actually some manufacturers are starting to wind things back now and realise that perhaps in some cases the use of sort of touchscreens to perform every operation has gone a little bit too far. As you say, it should be eyes on the road predominantly. And I think, you know, any other systems that encourage us to divert our attention away from that is really asking for a lot of problems.
Rod, we could always do double the time with you on this subject. Thank you
very much.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe we'll have, maybe we should just have an hour-long special about our cars and their changing nature. We'll do that sometime later on in the summer. We've got quite a lot of other busy news around at the moment, so forgive us for not doing it now. That is Senior Policy Officer Rod Dennis at the RAC. But there are so many messages coming in about your driving experiences and how they are changing. We know it is a bone of contention.
It really is, and I completely get that absurd obsession with life inside the vehicle when surely you've got to be... We were always told you keep your eyes on the road, don't you? Use your mirrors, look ahead.
Mirror, signal, manoeuvre.
Yes, all of that.
Don't press, tweak and swipe.
Yeah, it used to be bad enough when you could change your radio station. If you
don't...
Was- if you
don't change your radio station.
What was I thinking? It's Times Radio. We'll get the latest on the fighting between Iran, the US and Israel. We'll talk to a correspondent in Dubai. It's Greg Kostrom of The Economist, who knows his stuff. So he's coming next on Times Radio after the headlines with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Chancellor's insisted she has the right economic plan, despite the budget watchdog cutting its forecast for growth this year. Rachel Reeves' spring statement doesn't include any tax or spending changes, but the OBR says the tax burden is to hit a post-war high and welfare spending will continue at record levels. Sunday Times economics editor David Smith has been looking at the forecasts.
Growth is revised down a bit for this year. And I think that is because the OBR sees that there wasn't much momentum going into the new year. In fact, some of the business surveys we've had for the early part of this year have been quite strong. So, you know, there's a mixed picture there.
The UK is considering sending a major warship to Cyprus to help defend an RAF base on the island. Discussions are taking place about the potential deployment of a destroyer with the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles. The US and Israel are striking targets in Iran for a fourth day, with Tehran attacking America's allies in the region. The US Embassy in Saudi Arabia has issued a security alert, warning of imminent missile and drone attacks on the eastern city of Dahran, home to much of the country's oil industry. Elsewhere, a man who died after a skydive in Devon has been named as Ches McNeil from Poole. The 49-year-old, who was an experienced skydiver, was pronounced dead on Saturday. Investigations are ongoing. And BAFTA's host Ellen Cummings says people have been let down by broadcasting decisions made at the award show. A Tourette's campaigner involuntarily shouted a racial slur. Don't forget you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
The Philly cheese stack is back at McDonald's and it's still intensely cheesy. Imagine the cheesiest thing ever. Now cover it in cheese. Add two beef patties, cheddar cheese sauce, crispy onions and even more cheese. The Philly cheese stack. Did we mention it's cheesy? Available until the 16th of March 2026 from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary. Subject to availability.
I thought that I'd seen beauty. Then I sailed where icebergs gleam. I thought I'd witnessed nature. But this surpassed my dream. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar joins us in the studio to tell us what's on his programme between 4 and 7. Hello, John.
Hi there. Yeah, so, well, the first person I'm going to be talking to when we come on air at 4 o'clock is going to be David Petraeus, General Petraeus, the former head of the CIA, the former senior commander in the United States. He was the one who posed the question, which is now sort of echoing down the years, of how does this end? He was talking at that point about Iraq, but he's associated with the idea of having a strategy which needs to be thought through first. So I'm going to be interested in Petraeus' thoughts on where we are now with the war in Iran and what's the strategy, assuming there is a strategy, which is a question, I think, in some doubt. I've also talked to Jeremy Hunt, the former Conservative Chancellor and Foreign Secretary, to get his take on all of this. And I'm going to be watching, as we all are, the markets, where, you know, the FTSE index is in a bit of a vertical dive just at the moment. It's done a couple of percent now. The same can be said for oil and for gas, gas is going down even more steeply than oil, and oil is going down steeply enough. And you've got to wonder where this is going. And against that background, Starmer's choice of not diving in first with an immediate support and endorsement, might that work to his advantage? We'll see how this plays out. But it's a question for conversation throughout the show, including with Peter Westmacott, the former British ambassador to the United States.
It's all big stuff, and there's one man who can do it. It's you, John. It starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon. We did an interview with David Petraeus, didn't we, where we did ask him where he thought Donald Trump would be in 10 years' time. Can you remember his answer?
Oh, gosh. Can you?
Yep, standing on a balcony, wearing a dressing gown, shouting at cars.
Right. But that was that's not your assessment, because it's David Petraeus.
No, we asked him.
Right. Well, it'd be very interesting to hear what he says to John a little later here on Times Radio. We're staying with that all-important subject now. 130,000 British citizens have registered their presence in the Middle East with the government as the fighting continues. Iran has attacked a US base in Qatar and the American embassy in Saudi Arabia, vowing to open the gates of hell in response to US and Israeli airstrikes. We know, of course, that Donald Trump has criticised Keir Starmer over his stance on the conflict. He told The Sun that the special relationship isn't what it was and suggested the Prime Minister could well be pandering to Muslim voters here in the UK. Well, Greg Karlstrom is the Middle East correspondent for The Economist. And Greg, you are based in Dubai, so tell us what is happening there today.
I'm based in Dubai, but I'm actually in Riyadh at the moment in Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's a similar story in Dubai to what it's been in previous days. There have been ongoing Iranian missile and drone attacks, not just in Dubai, but elsewhere in the United Arab Emirates. There was an attack on Fujairah, for example, which is important because it's a port and an oil loading terminal that is outside of the Persian Gulf. And so it's something that if the Strait of Hormuz is closed or if it's hard for ships to get through the strait, they can use Fujairah to export oil and to import food and other essentials into the UAE. So obviously, if there were to be damage, significant damage at that port, that would have consequences for both the UAE and for energy prices around the world. So again, we're just seeing this continued campaign of Iranian strikes all across the Gulf.
As we speak, the strait is still open, isn't it? Is there any chance that it could or indeed will be shut over the coming days?
So I think we need to distinguish between the idea of the Iranians militarily closing the strait, imposing a blockade where their ships are, you know, lining the waterway and preventing anyone from going through it. I don't think they have the capacity to do that. Their navy has been struck repeatedly by the Americans over the past few days. And even if they tried to do that, I think they would quickly be pushed back by the Americans. But what's happening now is there is a risk sailing through the Strait of Hormuz. There is a risk that the Iranians will fire missiles at your ship or try to board your ship and seize it. And so because of that, you've had insurers that are canceling policies for vessels that normally go through the strait. You have cargo companies and other firms that are telling their ships not to pass right now and holding them outside of the strait. That's really the issue. It's not whether it can be militarily closed by the Iranians. It's whether Iran can create enough feeling of danger, feeling of risk that companies for economic reasons decide not to travel through the strait.
I mean, there's so much we could ask you, Greg, but I wonder if you can tell us who you think is giving the orders in Iran. Is it this man, Ali Larijani?
I'm not sure anyone is giving the orders at this point, really. I think it is certainly not the three-man interim leadership council that is meant to be running the country right now after the supreme leader was killed. I don't think that council is very powerful. I think there's a lot of infighting between people like Ali Larijani, who you mentioned, who's a very prominent regime figure, Mohammad Qalibaf, who's the Speaker of Parliament. People like that are vying for power behind the scenes, but no one individual, I think, is strong enough to take control. And then I think when it comes to the military and the strikes that we're seeing across the Gulf, I think very often Iranian units are acting in a self-directed way. I think command and control has broken down to some extent. I think what remains of the regime doesn't have direct control over every individual unit in the field. And so when you see Iranian drones crashing into hotels and airports and other civilian targets across the Gulf, I think that is often individual commanders acting at their own initiative because no one is in charge.
And can I ask you, as you are in Riyadh, what is the Saudi view of what's going on? What does MBS want to happen here?
The Saudis are furious, and there's been a real change in the Saudi position over the past few days. I mean, in the run-up to this war, the Saudis did not want the war to happen. They were urging the Trump administration back in January not to embark on this military buildup and not to strike Iran because they were worried about Iranian retaliation. But we've had days now of attacks on the Gulf, an attack on a Saudi oil refinery yesterday, The US embassy in Riyadh was hit by a drone overnight that collapsed the roof of the embassy. And there are officials here in Riyadh who are starting to feel like we have been dragged into this war by the Iranians against our will. We didn't want this war to happen, but we need to pick sides at this point. And there's a lot of talk about either allowing America to use Saudi bases to attack Iran or about the Saudi military getting involved directly. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next couple of days we see the Saudis explicitly pick a side in this war and get involved.
I mean, were Saudi troops to... I mean, are you actually talking about Saudi troops on the ground in Iran? Is that a possibility?
No, I don't think it will be Saudi troops on the ground. And I think certainly if the Americans are not on the ground, the Saudis are not about to do that unilaterally. But I think for the Saudis and for their neighbors in the Gulf, what they might start doing is what they're calling active defense. So not just waiting for Iranian missiles and drones to zoom overhead and then shoot them down, but actually carrying out strikes to try and destroy Iran's missile launchers, to try and strike at the bases from which it launches drones. I think they might do that sort of thing. It's something they can very easily sell to the public at home. People in the Gulf are very, very angry. And if you tell them, you know, we need to go carry out strikes to keep you safe, to prevent Iran from shooting missiles and drones at you, I think that would have pretty broad support.
Isn't there a possibility that the Gulf states will get sick and tired of incoming attacks from Iranian drones and beg Donald Trump to call the whole thing off?
That was Iran's hope. That is Iran's hope in carrying out these attacks. That's exactly the logic, that eventually the Gulf states will have to bend to the pressure. I think the dilemma for them right now is, on the one hand, they do want those attacks to stop. The cost is mounting. People have been killed. Airlines have been forced to suspend operations. Oil and gas companies have done the same. There's a multi-billion dollar economic cost to this already. But on the other hand, if you beg Donald Trump to stop the war and he listens to you and he stops the war, what happens then? You're left with the Iranian regime probably remaining in power across the Gulf. And the regime will learn that, hey, attacks on Gulf countries, that's a very effective tactic to put pressure on the Americans. And so if there is another war at some point in the future, Iran will strike at the Gulf, no doubt, even harder than it has this time around. And so there are some people arguing it's better to absorb the short-term pain now of a weeks-long conflict in order to try and achieve the longer-term goal of not having a hostile regime just a few hundred kilometers across the Persian Gulf.
Just to go back to something that John Pienaar, I know, is going to talk about in more detail with guests, including David Petraeus, after 4 o'clock. But are you confident that there is a Donald Trump plan for this military operation?
Not in the least. Not at all. No. I mean, you listen to everything that he has said over the past few days about his ever-changing objectives. We're going to make a deal. We're going to change the regime and free the Iranian people. We're going to degrade Iran's military capabilities. It's not clear that they see an endgame in this. And I think there are scenarios where Trump can declare victory, right? He can come in, smash the place up in Iran for 4 or 5 weeks, leave behind a fragmented, collapsing state. And then America can go back home and Trump can say, you know, Iran is no longer a problem for us, but it will remain a problem for countries in the region. It will remain a problem for Iranians themselves if that sort of state collapse happens there. So I don't think there's an endgame. I don't think they've thought this through. I think the administration believed this might be Venezuela 2.0, where we'll find some pliant regime insider who will work with us and take control and bend to America's demands. But we haven't seen any signs of that person emerging, and I would be very skeptical if that person does emerge in Iran.
So bearing all that in mind, our own Prime Minister's caution about all this doesn't seem such a bad move.
No, it's not. I think the dilemma for the UK and for other European countries in the days to come is going to be, on the one hand, you don't want to get embroiled in America's seemingly aimless war in Iran. On the other hand, this war is becoming a threat to your interests. We see what's happening to oil and gas prices over the past 2 days. We see scenes of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Brits and other Europeans who are stuck in the Gulf who can't get out. The UK has economic interests in these countries. So it doesn't want to see a prolonged war in the Gulf that is harmful to its allies in the Gulf. And it's going to come under increasing pressure from the Gulf states to get involved at least in their defense in a bigger way, perhaps even to the point of carrying out strikes inside of Iran to disrupt Iran's ability to fire missiles and drones. There's a desire in the Gulf to see the UK do that, to see France do that and other allies. And there's going to be pressure to step up involvement.
Really good to have your expertise this afternoon, Greg. Thank you very much. That's Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist. He was talking there from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia.
We're going to talk about incredibly expensive muesli in a couple of moments' time. Thank you for all of your thoughts about cars as well. And Mark, Jane and I completely agree with you on this. How come in-car screens are legal, but you can't glance at your mobile?
Makes no sense.
I think
sense.
You've got to ask some questions about these safety tests that the cars are being put through before they're being given the go-ahead, because I think in normal circumstances, an awful lot of people are going, no, that's not really very safe at all. This one in from Jenny, who says, I would like you to also discuss how cars aren't made for women. It drives me insane. I'm an average 5'4", size 3 feet, and for my whole driving life, I've only found two types of car that have pedals I can put my heel down on the floor at the same time as pressing it. I've never found a car where the headrest can be lowered enough for my head to be deemed safe, let alone a seatbelt that can't be lowered enough so it doesn't cut my neck off. Jenny, you have our sympathy. Yeah. We really hear you on that.
Size 3 feet, that's properly dainty, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Could paramedics start giving weight loss jabs at the scene of a heart attack and the all-important story about how healthy muesli really is? It's the latest health news from our resident doctor, Rachel Ward. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio, Market Watch, in association with F&C Investment Trust. Listen to Times Radio to hear all the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Get insight, analysis, and up-to-the-minute information to help you get the most from your investment portfolio. Times Radio, Market Watch. Throughout the day, every Monday to Friday, on Times Radio, in association with F&C. It's smart to start with F&C. Find out more at fnc.com. Capital at risk.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please, go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Imagine a breakfast wrap. You know the one, because there really is only one. Sausage, egg, cheese, bacon and a potato rosti all wrapped together. Yep, there it is. I think my work here is done. Served until 11 a.m.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
So let's talk about the world of health with Dr. Rachel Ward, GP and host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Hello, Rachel. Are you well?
Good afternoon. Yes, I'm really well. Thank you very much.
Good. We wanted to start with the latest story about weight loss drugs. I mean, is there anything these drugs can't do? Today's story is that they might be able to prevent damage from heart attacks. And there's a suggestion that they could be administered by paramedics at the scene of an attack. Why?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. Now, it's worth saying to start with that this is a very early study which has been carried out on mice. So this is a study, a collaboration between the University of Bristol and UCL, and they have looked at the effect of the GLP-1 drugs, so things like semaglutide, you know, Wegovy, Mounjaro, the things that we're used to hearing. And they've looked at the effect of these in the episode after a heart attack. They have found that there seems to be a benefit that improves the blood supply to the heart muscle after that initial event. And if you can restore the blood supply to heart muscle, that then reduces the problems of death of heart muscle and reduces the problem of heart failure after. Now, as I say, this is really early on in the trials. There's no clinical trials yet, but if it was to be beneficial, then yeah, this is something that potentially in the future could potentially be very easily administered. I think it's also, people sometimes think it's very strange to be looking at this kind of problem with drugs which were originally developed for diabetes. It's not an uncommon issue, not an uncommon event that we start using drugs for different things. There's another drug, for example, called dapagliflozin, which was developed for diabetes. We now use it as one of our first line heart failure meds. So this is not uncommon and really interesting that we are just finding more and more potential uses for this class of drug.
Yeah, I mean, they do just seem remarkable and we do talk about them every week. So let's move on to something that we probably don't talk about enough. The Boys Club shutting women out of private hospitals. And I say that we don't talk about it enough because actually you could think, well, that's a bit of a niche story, but it's becoming more and more important, isn't it? Because more and more people are using private healthcare.
Absolutely. So this is, again, a report. It's come out of the Royal College of Surgeons of England. We know that at the moment, so more than 50% of doctors now are women in the NHS, but only 17% of consultant surgeons are women. But this report looks at private hospitals, and that has identified that only 6% of surgeons operating privately are women. And I think, yes, you're absolutely right. You could say, well, you know, so what? What does that matter to the NHS? But I think this really just typifies and highlights the ongoing issue that we have in surgery of this incredibly misogynistic culture. There was an incredible piece in the Times in 2023, which looked at the fact that the culture of kind of sexual harassment in surgery, and it showed that more than two thirds of female surgeons said that they had been sexually harassed in the workplace. And of course, there is work to try and improve this culture, but this study just shows, you know, you scratch the surface and you identify this ongoing, as it's called, boys club of culture. So, the thought is that probably male surgeons are more likely to do well in the private sector because men are referring to men. There's also this issue that I really think that women who become consultant surgeons have been so up against it to get to that point in their career that the thought that they can then actually take on this additional private work is just too much of a burden. I think it's quite a niche outcome, but really does highlight a huge cultural problem which still exists in surgery.
Right. Gosh. Okay. Let's hope that changes. Certainly shining a light on it might help. Our last story, I think, is one that people are going to raise their eyebrows about. It's about muesli being just as unhealthy as children's chocolate cereal. And when you dig down into the comparisons, it is astounding what some of these brands are getting away with, Rachel, isn't it? They're billing themselves as a health food, but it is anything but.
Absolutely. So Which have done an analysis of 86 different mueslis. And I think we can all think, oh, muesli, healthy breakfast, you know, it's got oats and nuts in it. But when you start to actually uncover things like added sugar levels, some of these products are really not very healthy, whether that be through the sugar addition, through high amounts of even natural sugars like honeys and dried fruit, which have a lot of sugar in it. You start to then compare the levels, and they are in some cases equivalent to, as you say, these kind of chocolate cereals that we would deem as particularly unhealthy. I think what's also really interesting in this analysis is that often we really buy into this element of the brand words that imply health, and also the price. Some of these are incredibly expensive products, and they were not the ones that were coming out on top from a health perspective. I mean, what I would say is it just really does show the importance, first of all, of learning and being familiar with looking at food labels, understanding what you're looking for. Secondly, it's a really good example is if you can make your own, just try and do it and try and get into that habit. I know we're all short on time. You know, we don't all have the appetite to do that. But if that's the case, just familiarise yourself with looking at added sugar, total amounts of sugar, what your daily content is. We know that adults should not be having more than 30 grams of sugar per day, and children it's less. So start looking at these and you realise you've used your quota at breakfast. That obviously doesn't add up.
I'm going to name names here. This is all from a brilliant article in The Times. Waitrose Essential, no added sugar, which I would be drawn to. I'd think that that was going to do me good. That contains 19.5 grams of sugar per 100 grams. And that's nearly as much as the Kit Kat cereal, which is made of chocolate and wafers. And that's... So that's not right in my head. And also, let's take a look at Raw Gorilla Keto Mighty Muesli, which scores only 47 out of 100. Eat Natural Gluten-Free Muesli scored 50 out of 100. The Kit Kat cereal, to put this all into context, is 62 out of 100. So those two aren't very far off. And they're selling themselves, aren't they, on the fact that they're health foods. And you mentioned there the price comparison as well. Own brand products were the cheapest, costing about 20p per 100 grams. And the Gorilla Muesli, £2.20. For 100 grams. I mean, this is astonishing.
A very expensive product. And as I said, you know, things like Eat Natural, where you're automatically drawn into that and you can just assume you're buying something better. It's great advertising. It's great branding. But we just need to get better at looking what the contents are and what we're buying.
Rachel, we certainly do. Yeah.
Can we find out what a doctor has for breakfast? What do you have?
Oh, so my current favourite at the moment, I have raspberries and blueberries out of the freezer with chia seeds overnight with some Greek yoghurt, oats and coconut on top. That's my current favourite. Mm,
yeah. OK, well, that does sound very healthy. Well done.
Yeah, you pass. What do you have, Garvey?
I have a bagel.
OK, what's on the bagel?
A lot of butter and a bit of honey.
Right.
But am I ill? Hardly ever.
You're not so good, are you?
Well, no. Well, no. But it sees me through sometimes until 11s is
amazing. Rachel, thank you very much indeed for your company.
Thank you.
I mean, Rachel's right, and I'm wrong. I should make that clear.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And good afternoon from quite a sunny, spring-like London. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until four in the next hour. Does anybody involved in the attacks on Iran have a long-term plan for the future of the country? We'll talk to a veteran of military logistics. We'll look ahead to the Men's World Cup in the summer. Iran have qualified. Can they take part? And do you suffer from stubborn stains? Well, have no fear. Nancy Birtwistle is here. She's got a new bestseller. It's called Clean Magic. She's talking to Fee after after 3.30. Let's get the news bulletin at 3. Here's Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Chancellor has been giving an update on the economy in her spring statement, saying the government has restored stability. The OBR has downgraded GDP growth forecasts for this year from 1.4% to 1.1%, while inflation and government borrowing are also expected to be lower than previously thought. Rachel Reeves told the Commons she has the right economic plan. But for the Conservatives, Shadow Chancellor Sir Mel Stride said Reeves delivered a surrender statement.
The Chancellor has the temerity to suggest that she is creating the conditions for renewed growth. She is rather like the dodgy estate agent standing in the crumbling building with a roof gone, the windows gone, with the floor gone, and saying, just think of the potential.
Britain is planning to send a warship to Cyprus to defend RAF Akrotiri from Iranian attacks. The Times has been told a destroyer with the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles could arrive in the region in a week. The US and Israel are striking targets in Iran for a fourth day, with Tehran attacking America's allies in the region. Iran is threatening to fire on any ships attempting to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, an important route for moving oil. Brent crude has jumped to more than $84 a barrel, while UK wholesale gas prices have also surged. Professor Fawaz Gerger, a Middle East specialist at the London School of Economics, says things could get worse.
Now Israel has expanded the war into Lebanon. I expect the Houthis in Yemen to join the war any moment now. So what started as a simple and easy campaign to bring about regime change in Iran is really now escalating into a region-wide conflict with potential significant consequences on the world economy affecting Europe and the United Kingdom as well.
Yeah, motorists are being urged to avoid panic buying of fuel, with long queues seen at some petrol forecourts. The AA says they should fill up as normal, as any price rises will take some days to come through to the pumps. A judge says all trials of those charged with supporting Palestine Action have been put on hold. Chief Magistrate Paul Goldspring says cases will be reviewed again at the end of July. The government is challenging a High Court ruling that banning the group under the Terrorism Act was unlawful. The Prime Minister has carried out a mini reshuffle of his junior ministers after the resignation of Josh Simons. He stood down after it emerged a think tank he led had smeared Sunday Times journalists. Bury North MP James Frith has replaced him as Parliamentary Secretary in the Cabinet Office. The rapper Getz has been sentenced to 12 years in prison for killing a Nepali student in a hit and run. The award-winning British artist, whose real name is Justin Clark Samuel, pleaded guilty to causing the death of 20-year-old Yubin Tamang in London last year. And one of the country's richest men says he's applying for German citizenship over hostility to Jews. Welsh venture capitalist Sir Michael Moritz says the rise of anti-Semitism prompted him to seek an insurance policy. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's coming up to 4 minutes past three. It's Jane and Fee with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Let's get straight to it then. As Operation Epic Fury enters its fourth day, the focus has shifted from initial strikes to a massive logistical war of attrition. Reports from the Times suggest the UK currently has no ability to defend Cyprus against ballistic missile attacks, leaving RAF Akrotiri dangerously exposed to Iranian retaliation. To counter this, Britain is reportedly planning to rush a warship to the region to shield our most critical Mediterranean hub. Well, let's talk about this with a man who really knows his onions, General Tim Cross. General Cross served as Director General of the Defence Supply Chain. He served in Kosovo and Iraq and also has knowledge of Cyprus and has been an advisor to the Defence Select Committee. We couldn't wish for a better guest, General Cross. A very good afternoon from us.
Well, you better manage your expectations, I think.
No. We don't need that at all. Tell us, will sending a single warship to defend Akrotiri be enough to secure what must be a depleted missile stockpile? Do you think that this is a bit of a sticking plaster or a jolly good thing?
No, it's the right thing to do. I mean, the bottom line is we have, all through my career, 43 years I served, man and boy, we have assumed that we could operate from secure bases, the UK home base, from places like Cyprus and indeed Gibraltar and, you know, the other bases we've got around the world. The world has changed in the last few years, and the reach of these unmanned aerial vehicles and, of course, missiles has extended the ability of any country to reach deeply into and long range, you know, into places like Cyprus. So we didn't have any air defences in Cyprus deployed there. The destroyer that's probably going to go does have the ability to shoot down missiles and drones and so on. And I would think probably is sufficient in the sense that I don't think Cyprus is about to be hit hard by lots of these things. But it does reinforce the point that we don't have this capability, not just in Cyprus, frankly, but in the UK home base. And people have been talking about this for several years now, little or nothing has been done about it. And one of the problems is we've given a lot of stuff to Ukraine, and we don't have a great inventory of these sorts of systems.
Right. So what's the best case scenario? What's the worst case scenario?
Well, the worst case scenario is that Iran does reach out and you know, hit places like Cyprus with a lot of missiles. I don't honestly think that's going to happen, but they're clearly hitting many of the countries in the Gulf. And as the Prime Minister said, many of those countries have asked us to help them. And we're using air power. We're using the F-35s and, the other airplanes that we've got in service. And Akrotiri is a major RAF base and has got a lot of air power based at it. So I'm not overly worried, to be honest. I mean, I may be wrong, you know, things can change quickly, but I'm not overly worried from the immediacy of that. Longer term, we have got to do something about the defence of the UK home base. And that requires a lot of money. These missile defence systems are expensive and you need to have a lot of them. And we're seeing that, you know, in spades in all of these Middle East conflicts over these last few years. For every 100 drones that are launched, the mass of them, 95% of them will be shot down, but 5% will get through. But it'll be more than 5% if you don't have the ability to shoot down the other 95%. And the long-range missiles and the hypervelocity missiles and so forth are even more difficult to shoot down. So as part of the change in defence for our own nation, as part of the strategic review that went on, we have got to do something about missile defence.
When you say that you've been calling for this and others have been calling for this for some time, can you put that into context? Is that call in response to what else you've seen, or it was just we hope that this might go into the right in tray?
Well, you know, I always hesitate to criticise prime ministers, defence secretaries or anybody else.
Don't say whatever you want.
That's your job, not mine.
Okay.
These are very, very difficult choices and difficult appointments. And they, you know, they are tough choices. And what the prime minister's, you know, deciding to do at the moment, he's very conscious of the heritage of Tony Blair from 2003, which I was involved with. I was in Baghdad in 2003 and it went badly wrong. We know that. I was also, funny enough, I was at a dinner in London last week for the 35th anniversary of the first Gulf War, which I was involved with, which went, you know, pretty well. These are very difficult choices. And when you do a defence review, there are lots of things that need to happen, like all priorities in government. But I, from a personal point of view, I have been saying for a long time, as in 20 years or so, that we have assumed for too long that we can operate from a secure home base. And from a logistic point of view, what I meant by that was we have our seaports, places like Marchwood, where we deploy our assets from the UK and our airfields in the UK, and we deploy them to places like Cyprus. So when I was stood up to be the logistic component commander for the war in 2003, I was given command of two logistic brigades and the logistics in Cyprus to enable us to do what needed to be done. And one of my, you know, comments to people, my questions and so forth is, how secure are these? Is this base in Cyprus going to be? And to be honest, I didn't get very positive answers.
Okay.
So I don't want to be clever about it. I've been banging on about this for quite a long time, but I'm not alone in that.
Sure. Do you think that this vulnerability might be the thing that does push us from defensive to offensive?
Well, you know, we have got limited capability to conduct offensive operations over a long period of time. In Iran, I mean, it is a bit like dancing on pinheads here. I mean, slightly different comment. And remembering that the prime minister is a lawyer, I can remember having conversations with lawyers about the distinction between low intensity and high intensity operations. To which my answer was, if you're the bloke being shot at, it's a pretty high intensity operation. And the distinction between defensive and offensive operations is pretty nuanced. If you're the bloke they're dropping bombs on in Iran, it's not matter to you whether it's defensive or offensive. But nonetheless, and to be fair to the prime minister, what he's saying is we will use our assets not to go over Iran and bomb Iran as with the Americans and the Israelis. We will use them to defend our airspace over Cyprus and indeed the other Gulf states. And that requires, you know, certain capability. And we have got that capability deployed in Cyprus and it can be reinforced. Mm. But for the, you know, the amount of stuff that we have, the sustainability and the endurance that we have, the resilience that we have, is pretty limited. It has to be said. I mean, I don't know the current figures, but I know they're pretty limited.
As you mentioned, you served in Iraq. You were critical of the post-war planning for the second Gulf War. Woefully thin, I think, is how you described it to the Iraq Inquiry. So I wonder how you feel about this current engagement. I know it's not our campaign at the moment, but everybody is speculating as to what the end game is and whether or not there's any planning for that at all, actually.
Well, I'm not sure that there is. I don't want to begin to be clever about this. When I was in Washington, the plan for Iraq in 2003 was that we would put in ground forces, which we'll come back to in a moment in context of Iran, and we will get rid of Saddam Hussein, and the Iraqi people will stand up, give us a thunderous round of applause, and turn themselves into some sort of Western democracy. I mean, it was you know, unbelievable, really. And I remember saying to Rumsfeld, Secretary of State, OK, that might be plan A, but what's plan B and what's plan C? Now, as far as Iran is concerned, nobody is suggesting putting ground forces in there. So when President Trump talks about a change of regime, ultimately, it has to come from within. And the only way that's going to happen, in my view, is if the Iranian Republican Guard and their internal security forces say to the new regime, the newly elected leadership of the regime, we are not prepared to use force against the people on the streets in places like Tehran and elsewhere. Now, that's not unprecedented. Cold War came to an end when the Berlin Wall came down, and countries like East Germany and Romania and many of the other Eastern European countries under communism, their members of their securities just laid down their weapons and said, we're not prepared to shoot our own people. And these things can change quite quickly. But I'm not convinced that in Iran at the moment that we're anywhere near that position. Bombing it has hardened views, undoubtedly. It's probably consolidated views and so forth. So what is the end state here? What does it look like? What does it look like, in 6 months, years' time? I don't honestly know or believe that anybody's got a clear intent for that. Of course you can continue to bomb. Of course you can continue to take out Republican Guard barracks and missile systems and all that sort of stuff. But ultimately, where does that leave you? And unless you're prepared to put people on the ground, you can't guarantee the change. And we know that that went badly wrong in Iraq, and it went badly wrong in Afghanistan too.
President Trump also said last night that the big one is coming soon. I mean, he really isn't talking about all of those things that you've just mentioned. When he talks, he is still using the words of aggression, the words of war about this campaign. And I wonder whether, when you heard that, I mean, what did you think that that means?
Well, in all honesty, what I first thought was this huge bomb that they've got, which they can drop, that's deep penetration, goes deeply into the under the surface of the earth to take out Iranian nuclear capability. Now, supposedly, they'd done that in the past. And you will remember, as I do, President Trump standing up not that long ago, last summer, saying that they had, damaged and I don't know whether he used the word destroyed, but damaged and degraded the Iranian nuclear capability. So when I heard that expression, I just found myself thinking he's talking about dropping these very big bombs using B-2s or the strategic bombing capability to do that. I can't believe he's talking about anything to do with ground forces, as I say, and Israel certainly isn't going to put ground forces in there. So I don't know what he means, but that's what the first thing that came to my mind.
Right. Do you think that the UK should be part of a ground force were it ever to come to that?
No, and we haven't got the capability to do it, frankly. I mean, the Prime Minister has been talking about capability putting into Ukraine in some sort of international coalition of the willing, etc., but our capability is very limited today. I mean, the army that I left 20 years ago, it was, substantial and capable. That is just not the case today, sadly. I mean, the government keep talking about spending more money on defence and recruiting and so on, but the reality is that just isn't happening at the moment. So in my view, there's absolutely no way we will put ground forces into Iran. Mm.
President Trump also says that our Prime Minister Keir Starmer has been unhelpful. I mean, I know that you probably don't want to make a specific comment about a specific person, but if you could just interpret that question as me asking you what you think of the current political situation, what would your answer be?
Well, Trump has this, trying to get inside the mind of President Trump is clearly an impossibility, really. He has a great fondness for this country. We know that. He's got a golf course in Scotland. He's a great fan of the royal family. I think he genuinely has, likes the UK in the round. And American presidents are used to the fact that we have always supported them in these sorts of operations. Again, I don't want to bang on about 2003, but ultimately, Prime Minister Blair went with the Americans because he felt that from a grand strategic point of view, that was absolutely the right thing to do. And I think he genuinely believed the Americans would succeed there. The current prime minister is not of the same mind. I mean, he, as I said earlier, he's very conscious of that legacy of Blair, and he doesn't want to be talked about in 20 years' time in the same way. And I think he does genuinely care about international law, which is why I think he struggled to make a choice and a decision about whether to support them from day one or not. And the changes, that he's had in the last 24 hours reflects the change of circumstances there. But at the end of the day, my view is that we Iran is a nasty regime. We know that. It sponsors terrorism, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis and all the rest of it. So I have no problem with seeing a change of regime in Iran. Should we be supporting an America and Israel in that intent? At the end of the day, my answer to that is yes. The question then is, how do you do that? And the fact that we've not been prepared from day one to allow them to use our bases and supported them with air power, which we've done in various other places in Syria and indeed in the earlier Iran engagements, I personally regret. But all choices carry consequences, and often an awful lot of unintended consequences. So making these choices as Prime Minister and Defence Secretary is tough, which is why, you know, I'm not going to condemn him for it. I don't agree with what's emerged. But at the end of the day, he's got to make the choices. He's got to live with the consequences.
Yep. I mean, I do have to say, Major General, I don't think it's you banging on at all. I hope you don't feel that you are, because surely we are total fools if we don't learn the lessons from history. And if we don't listen to people like you who were there in previous conflicts, who saw what, I don't know whether you'd call it benign ignorance, actually does to people's lives. That's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You're right. And I think the great tragedy of 2003 was the Americans had no sense at all about the division between the various sects within the Muslim faith. So, understanding conflict and winning the battle of ideas is all very well used. I'm not against using military power, clearly. But at the end of the day, you've got to be clear. What are you trying to achieve? What's the best way of achieving it, and what's it going to look like when it's finished? And my experience, to be fair, Kosovo, if you go back to Kosovo and Tony Blair's speech in Chicago, when he talked about the fact the world is changing and we can't just watch as people are massacred inside their own countries, that was as a result of Rwanda. It was a result of what was happening in the Balkans. And he undertook Kosovo, even though it wasn't it wasn't legal. The UN Security Council did not pass a resolution that legalized internationally the move into Kosovo. But most people at the time, and I think subsequently, will argue it was legitimate and it was successful. And there's no doubt in my mind at all, as a result of that, Tony Blair was emboldened, if you like, to be involved in 2003. So it's not just about international law. It's about, what's the right thing to do, legitimacy and so on. But it is also about understanding the lessons of history. And the division between Sunni and Shia, the Americans never had, I'm probably exaggerating slightly, but I don't think they had much of a clue between that. And they were very genuinely surprised when the Civil War broke out. And in the context of what's going on now, we know that, the divisions between Iran and countries like Saudi Arabia and others is a pretty serious division. I agree with you. Of course, you've got to understand history, and you can't just dismiss it and say, well, times have changed. You don't just assume everything is the same by any manner of means, but you do need to understand what's happened in the past. And particularly in this part of the world where this is, I can tell you when I was in Washington in 2002 and they were planning this Iraq operation, they were already saying what comes next. And they were talking about Iran then. So that's 20 odd years ago. But the Middle East has been going on clearly since 1948. I remember the 67, 73 wars and all the rest of it. And, it's a very troubled region. And you need to be jolly careful before you start these things.
That is a deliciously British way of putting it. We should be jolly careful. It's very good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for
your
time.
You're very welcome.
That's Major General Tim Cross.
Just worth saying that the Foreign Secretary has said that 130,000 British nationals had signed up for the Register Your Presence programme, which is available across some states in the Middle East, Bahrain, Israel, Kuwait, Palestine, Qatar and the UAE. In the last couple of minutes, British Airways has released a statement about the evacuation plan for the region. Here is that BA statement. Working with the relevant authorities, we have been able to schedule a flight for those customers to travel from Muscat to London. The flight will depart at 2:30 local time on the 5th of March, and we're asking customers who are in Amman to contact us if they wish to travel on this flight. We expect significant interest and therefore will assign seats on a first-come, first-served basis. That's going to be quite a tricky situation, I suspect, for many. Coming up next on Times Radio, there are 100 days now until the Men's Football World Cup kicks off. Will Iran be there? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio. Trusted journalism.
Well, today we are watching the world order being demolished and rebuilt pretty much at the whim of two strongman leaders.
Intelligent analysis.
But it adds to the impression that life is hard and maybe too hard under the new government.
And diverse opinion.
We'll be hearing the thoughts and the arguments on either sides and in between and some of the complex issues. How can this end well?
John Pienaar at Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
I thought I'd seen it all.
At Tesco Mobile, club card prices are frozen, so your contract price stays on ice. So you can get our unlimited data sim for just £20 a month for 24 months with club card prices, saving you a huge £120. And it stays like that for the length of your contract. It pays to be connected. Search Tesco Mobile. Every little helps. End 22nd of March. Club card and 24-month credit agreement required. Savings calculated on contract duration. Terms at tescomobile.com/terms.
Then felt myself awaken. I thought I'd witnessed beauty before my breath was taken. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
1983 election, she's won a landslide second term.
Police have been deployed to disperse crowds as the poll tax riots escalate.
Credit crunches continuing to spread from the USA.
Britain has left the European Union.
I mean, the list goes on. Boris, Liz,
we've
Richie.
Helped Britain invest through 45 years of change. That's why we're the UK's number one investment and savings platform, trusted by 2 million people. Hargreaves Lansdown, helping Britain invest for it all. Investment returns vary. For claim verification, visit hl.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
The countdown is on for the FIFA Men's World Cup. Only 100 days until kickoff in North America. And I don't know why I'm speaking in with a slightly... because I'm actually really looking forward to it. But following events in the Middle East, there is an urgent question hanging over this huge sporting event. Will Iran be there? Could they be there? Sports journalist Vassos Alexander joins us every Monday to Thursday at around this time to talk sport. So, Iran, can they play in the World Cup?
Yeah, I mean, would they send their team to the USA and would the USA let them in? Martin Ziegler's been writing in the Times Online and he has like top contacts within FIFA. And he says that there have been, quote, crisis talks amongst FIFA to ask this very question. There are some quotes from the president of the Iranian FA, Mehdi Taj, who's been speaking on state television. He says currently it's unlikely we can look forward to the World Cup. FIFA officially are monitoring developments, and privately they say they do expect Iran to be there, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, they have qualified before, haven't they? It's not the first
time. This would be their fourth time in a row at the World Cup. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, they're old hands at qualifying for the Men's World Cup. You know, would they be there? The thing is, 100 days to go. 100 days isn't quite... you know, stick up your wall charts, but it's...
you're getting there.
It's, for goodness sake, don't cancel your Times subscription because the wall charts are coming.
Right, OK. Well done on message, Mandy.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely fantastic swerve right into the bosom of our employer there, Vassos. Yeah.
Brilliantly done.
Do we know which group Iran are in? Who are they scheduled to play? And could they be replaced by the nation that narrowly missed out?
At the moment, we literally don't know who, what the sort of the lucky loser situation would be. Yes, it would presumably be whoever just missed out to Iran in that qualifying campaign. Right. But yeah, I think what FIFA are hoping is that within the next month or so, there are still qualifiers to take place later this month. Northern Ireland and Wales are in action. They could actually play each other for the right to be at the World Cup. So they're both in semi-final action. Northern Ireland play Italy, Wales play Bosnia on, I think, the 26th of March, which is a Thursday, and the finals the following Monday or Tuesday. So, I mean, FIFA will be hoping, let's get those out of the way, and then hopefully there'll be a little bit more clarity in the situation. Because it's a very fast-moving, you know, situation, of course, and you just never know what's happening in a month. Last week, we were talking about whether Mexico could possibly host their 13 games.
Totally because, forgotten about that.
Yeah, because of all the violence, the drug cartel violence that's happening in Mexico.
Yeah. There is, obviously, as we know, a fast friendship between Donald Trump and Mr. Infantino of FIFA. Presumably they've been yapping on the phone.
Well, according to Mr. Ziegler in that article, some football figures privately are questioning the FIFA president Gianni Infantino's decision to award Donald Trump the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize.
The Peace Prize. It's looking a bit dodgy, isn't it?
Doesn't it? A little bit. I mean, this was only in December. Mm. So, like, 3 months ago.
Like you say, things change. I mean, you can change your mind.
Well, it's not like it was a very long-established Peace Prize, was it? So maybe
no,
it just
sort of
pops out of the cupboard this once and pops back in.
Yeah,
forevermore.
I mean, it was the first ever FIFA Peace Prize.
Yes.
It was so clearly just made up so that we could just, you know, have a little bit of a handshake and a smile and a camera moment between Infantino and Donald Trump.
Yeah. So, Jane and I had literally, Vassos, never said, I wonder when it is that FIFA's going to bring a peace prize to the
crying out.
This
for
is
it.
What we have. Football has been missing. A global peace prize to be awarded to a head of state.
It really has. I mean, generally speaking, I know it is a generalisation, soccer isn't a huge game in the States. I mean, the World Cup has been held there before, hasn't it? Is this going to actually turn the whole thing around, and will soccer suddenly become the game that the whole of the USA and other parts of America thrill to?
I tell you what, in the last couple of years, Lionel Messi almost single-handedly has really helped just ignite interest in. So before that, Inter Miami games had and then this is, you know, Inter Miami owned by David Beckham, and he's got star quality there as well. But when Lionel Messi joined Inter Miami, then the tickets, just the requests for tickets, I think, went 30-fold.
Right.
So it's getting there. It'll never be the NFL. It'll never be baseball or basketball, but there is a certain groundswell of people that are really excited about the World Cup. And actually, speaking of like the World Cup and politics, we're told today that the England players especially are a little bit worried about being asked to be political spokespeople. You know, we're there to play football. We're not there. And, you know, you remember 3-4 years ago in Qatar, when, you know, LGBTQ plus rights came under the spotlight and England players felt a little bit thrown under the bus being asked about that. They're thinking, you know, gosh, if it's going to be such a political World Cup, we need to have clear lines of press inquiry on us.
I'm indebted to Mary, who's just sent me the fixtures for the Islamic Republic of Iran at the World Cup.
Thank you, Mary. Me too.
Yeah, they were due to start playing New Zealand on June the 15th in Group G. And then the next game is against Belgium and then against Egypt. So, yeah, I mean, it's, I suppose that they'll just have to replace them with the team that just was squeezed out. So there can't be any other way around it.
Yes, there you go. Yes, New Zealand, Belgium in LA and then Egypt in Seattle. I knew I'd written it down. And
no,
all I could
I
see was the
you.
England and Scotland.
But we've also got
fixtures.
Mary working on it all. So
thank you very much. Well, Mary, you get my fee today.
Right. Yes. Well, she'll hold you to that. We'll contact you, Mary. Thank you very much. Vassos, thank you. And we're not going to say any more about the World Cup in the summer, which will, of course, be won by
England.
That's it. Thank you.
Glyn's contributions this afternoon have been absolutely fantastic. Will the Times be issuing a FIFA Peace Prize wall chart?
Yes.
Yes.
I think that's a goer. We've approved it.
Vassos, lovely to see you. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Our big guest after the 3:30 news is Bake Off winner and best-selling author Nancy Birtwistle, who will be discussing her new book, Clean Green Home. Let's get a check on the very latest news headlines. First with Stuart Woolley.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Conservatives say the Chancellor's plan is not working following her spring statement as the budget watchdog downgrades its growth forecast. Rachel Reeves insists she has the right economic plan for the country. The OBR has predicted GDP will grow by 1.1% in 2026. Tina McKenzie of the Federation of Small Businesses hopes for more support from the Chancellor.
If you walk up and down your own high street, they're all struggling. So she has a responsibility, irrespective of what's going on, to listen and to take action where needed, because this downgrade in the economic growth, we don't want that to be a continuation. And she's got to really get in and do something to support those businesses.
The UK is considering sending a major warship to Cyprus to help defend a military base on the island. It's after attacks on RAF Akrotiri. State agencies in Iran say a building where officials are due to decide the country's new supreme leader has been destroyed. Civilians have been warned to leave areas near an industrial site in Tehran. Also, a person's been arrested after a man was seriously injured in a lunchtime stabbing in Birmingham. A woman also suffered injuries that aren't life-threatening or changing. A 32-year-old man's been detained and remains in custody. And the rapper Getz has been jailed for 12 years for killing a 20-year-old student in a hit-and-run. He was speeding and had been drinking when his car hit Nepalese national Ubin Tamang in northeast London. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
I thought that I'd seen beauty.
At Tesco Mobile, club card prices are frozen, so your contract price stays on ice. Get the iPhone 17 with 12 gigs of data and an iPad, all for just £45.99 a month for 36 months with club card prices, saving you £126. And it stays like that for the length of your contract. It pays to be connected. Search Tesco Mobile. Every little helps. Ends 22nd of March. Club card and 36-month credit agreement required. Savings calculated on contract duration. Terms at tescomobile.com/terms.
Every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wickes.co.uk.
It is 27 minutes to four. Nancy Birtwistle is a phenomenon. In every decade of her life, she's turned her hand to something new and aced it, taking her dog to Crufts in her 30s, earning a master's degree in her 40s, learning French in her 50s, winning Bake Off in her 60s, and topping the bestseller charts in her 70s with her green guides to keeping your house clean. She works her magic with things like baking soda, ivy, and sunlight, and she's built up an almost cult-like following of people whose cupboards contain her cleaning recipes. Her message is very clear. You do not need chemicals in your life in order to be clean. Nancy, welcome to the afternoon show and off air with Jane and Fee. How are you today?
I'm very well. How are you two girls?
Well, we're very well indeed. Both of us have lost ourselves in your latest book, Clean Magic, Essential New Tricks for a Sparkling Green Home, because it contains such fantastic domestic wisdom. So we've got an awful lot of very specific questions about tea towels and stains and all of that kind of stuff. But we'll try and broaden our conversation to include our lovely listeners. And I think, first of all, for anybody who doesn't completely understand your manifesto, tell us a little bit about the magic, because actually that is more than just a noun to you, isn't it?
I think where it all started, which is over 10 years ago now, I started to, and it started so simply, I just flipped the bottle of fairy liquid that I had standing by the sink, and the reverse label shocked me because it said toxic to aquatic life with long-lasting effects. I thought, I've never noticed that before. We've got a baby on the front and we've got all this hazardous stuff going on at the back. So I then took a trip to the supermarket to find that this statement is on just about everything. And I think every cleaning product, I should say. And I think I've been around long enough to remember my grandmother using things like bicarbonate of soda and vinegar, but not in a sophisticated way or a 21st century type way. She just used to sprinkle bicarb in the bath and she'd pour vinegar down the sink and this sort of thing. And I think over the years we've become brainwashed into believing that natural products are inferior to the harmful synthetic fragrances that we've got used to. And so I started off very simply and then just kept going, and it's become a whole lifestyle change, really. And I think there is definitely an appetite for it because more and more people, well, I mean, the books are speaking for themselves.
Aren't they just? And is it true, Nancy, that actually you struggled to get the first book published? I mean, there must be some boardrooms of publishing houses that have the scent of regret about them, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, my first book, obviously I had a bake-off win under my belt, and I went round to so many publishers, as did my agent on my behalf, lots of London publishing houses, and I just couldn't get anything off the ground. I was told the market was saturated. I'd included, it was basically a baking and cooking book, but I'd included a sustainability chapter at the end where I'd talked about switching to green alternatives for cleaning. And so I had to self-publish, yeah. And it took a lot out of me because I signed every single copy and dispatched 12,000 from my dining room.
Right. Well, good for you. Good for you. I mean, it's paid off, hasn't it? If people want to start somewhere, they should start by making some of your extraordinary magic potions. So what do they need and what will they then be able to do?
Well, I think what I'd do, if I was starting from scratch, and I get messages from lots of people saying, I've bought the books and I'm ready to start, what shall I do? And it can seem, because it really is a lifestyle change. And so I would wait and see which bottle runs out first under the sink, and whichever it is, decide to replace that with a homemade recipe. I think a really good all-rounder is my all-purpose spray because it has so many uses. You can use it to clean the sink, the bathroom. You can clean your car interior. You can clean glass and mirrors, cupboards, all that sort of thing. It'll cut through grass. Cut through grease. It'll cut through grease. And that's a good starting point, I think.
Do you think one of the biggest blockers to people taking up your challenge to be cleaner and greener is that they think that they might actually be putting themselves and their family at risk? Because we have very much been sold the message that chemicals and strong chemicals are necessary in our house. That antibacterial thing is what's going to save us, and we can only find it in a bottle with chemicals in it.
Well, I think at the end of the day, I think we've gone too much the other way. I think people are afraid of, I mean, I got a message from a follower because I've got my own laundry detergent liquid in there. And I got a message from a follower, this is going back a few years, and she said, but what about the bacteria on socks? And I'm thinking, I mean, there will be specialists out there that will disagree with me, but I'm thinking bacteria on socks. Without bacteria, we would probably not survive because we have bacteria in our skin, we have bacteria in our gut. It's not all harmful. And if we switch over to natural products, washing soda, sodium carbonate is naturally antibac. Vinegar is naturally antibac. And so my own personal feeling is I think we've gone too far the other way.
Sure. And is there a recipe in your books that people can turn to that you know will kill as many bacteria, if you did want to kill any bacteria, and is antiviral in the same way that a lot of cleaning products claim to be?
Well, obviously, I haven't got the facility to be able to test bacteria under my products. What I would say is my all-purpose cleaner does have surgical spirit in it. So, and if you remember, there was surgical spirit in hand sanitizers and things. So I'm more than comfortable with using my all-purpose spray to wipe down surfaces before I start cooking, to wipe down my boards, to clean down the bathroom and that sort of thing. You know, if people are so, so nervous about germs and bacteria, I'd be more nervous of the chemicals that have been put in those products. I really would.
Yeah. And how old are you now, Nancy, if that's not too pertinent a question?
71, knocking on the door of 72 next month.
Right, and you look fabulous and you sound fabulous, so it's definitely working for you. We have got some questions from our listeners. This one comes in from David, who's got an espresso coffee spill on a cream wool carpet. Gosh, he's a man of some taste, isn't he? He's yes. used a spot clean vac to clean it immediately, but the stain remains. Help, please. How can you help, David?
Right, well, tea and coffee stains on carpets came in my first book, but basically it's a good all-round recipe that will shift coffee, tea, fruit juice, dog accidents, vomit. It's really good, and you just want tepid water, 2 or 3 tablespoons of white vinegar, a squirt of eco-friendly washing up liquid, not fairy, and don't froth it up. Just use it as a solution and work from the outside of the stain, working inwards. Dab at the carpet, don't rub it, and don't overwet it.
Okay, that's very sensible advice. You should know as well that our colleague Hugo Rifkin had a bit of dog vomit on a tufted wool stair carpet. Oh. We discussed this on his show earlier this morning, and it turns out on page 168 of Clean Magic, Nancy, you've got a solution to exactly that. It's yes. extraordinary. So we've handed it on to Hugo. We're very much hoping for some before and after shots. But if somebody else has got the same thing going down, you recall a follower, I'm reading now, feeling that she would need to throw her beautiful lamb's wool rug away because a sick dog had stained it badly. Rather than throw it away, we decided to try this instead. You need a wooden spoon, a metal dog comb, very hot water, some wool detergent, green bleach, fabric softener. Bob's your uncle, off you go. I mean, there's nothing that you can't tackle, is there?
Yes. Yeah. I will give anything a go. And obviously I've tackled lots of cleaning problems that have presented to me in my own house and family. But then what's also useful is people do send me questions, and this was one of them. And I didn't have the said rug with vomit on it, but I said, look, if you're not worried about it and you were going to throw it away anyway, let's try this. And so that's really satisfying when we can sort something out across social media with followers.
Yeah. We'll chuck some more questions your way in the last 10 minutes of the interview, but so much else to talk about. You did win Bake Off. Do you think Nigella Lawson is a good choice for the replacement for Prue Leith?
I think Nigella will be absolutely brilliant. I mean, I do know her a little bit, and she is such fun and a lovely person, and I think she will fill those bakers with confidence, actually.
Yeah, I think it's a genius, genius choice. I worry rather that Paul Hollywood might explode, though. Do you think he'll cope?
I can't wait to watch. I cannot wait. I think it'll be hilarious in lots of ways.
Yeah, I think so too. I just think he will have met his match. I mean, he's had fantastic, fantastic co-presenters so far in Mary Berry and Prue Leith, but I think Nigella might just fell him. What was your favourite showstopper or bake that you made on the Bake Off, Nancy?
I think the final, obviously, was, there are parts of it I can't even remember because it was so full on. But for me, in that final, I think everything just seemed to slot into place. And my red windmill, my Moulin Rouge, I'd practiced it so many times, and I was on my knees because the last practice was through the night, because I couldn't get it done in the time. We had 5 hours and I couldn't get it done in 5 hours. So I did my very last practice from midnight to, I don't know, 5 in the morning, something like that. And so by the time I got into the Bake Off tent for the final, I was completely sleep deprived. I mean, you know, it wasn't until afterwards that you realised just how tiring it was. But that last practice made such a difference because it gave me a confidence that I could do it in the time, because I was left with 10 minutes spare. and it all went to plan. So I think that has to be my favourite bake, favourite showstopper.
Hang on a second, Nancy. You did that practice bake the night before you went into the tent for the actual final day?
No. We used to have to leave home on the Friday.
Right.
To arrive at the tent Friday night and then start work Saturday morning. So it was that.
So you'd done it the Thursday night.
Yes,
and then, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. But once I got to the venue, I didn't sleep like a log at all. I don't think anybody does. You know, you're just thinking through what's going to happen the next day, rehearsing in your head the order that you're going to do things, worrying about what the technical challenge might be and whether you've got everything covered. And yeah.
Yeah. And the standard is so, so high, isn't it? I did think, I'm just such a fan of the whole series, but I did worry slightly in the last series that everything was completely and utterly beyond my ability to try at home as a very, very amateur home baker. Do you worry about that at all?
Yes, because, I mean, Bake Off, when I first became a fan, I found it really inspirational. I used to practice the technical challenge, never thinking I would ever do the show myself, but I used to practice the technical challenge. I remember practicing Mary's chocolate tea cakes, and they were brilliant. And so it made me want to try new things. I think when it gets too complex and too completely off the wall, that, all right, it's TV and it's entertainment, but it's not going to make you want to go and get in the kitchen.
Yeah, I completely, completely agree. It's the sugar domes that I couldn't cope with in the last one. I'm just never going to wake up.
You're never going to do it.
No, yeah. And go, oh, I want to make a sugar dome.
But you have been
today.
On Bake Off, haven't you?
The sport relief one, yeah, years and years ago, when they couldn't find anybody else.
What did you make?
I tried to make sausage rolls, and my pastry was very odd. I ended up making a sausage roll that looked like the Isle of Man.
Right.
Okay. I didn't win.
It's a tribute to the Isle of Man.
Not really. I don't know what happened. Do you want to do Rosie's query?
Yeah, can you help Rosie out, please, Nancy? She says, please, please. I mean, she's a desperate woman. My baby has knocked oil-based foundation makeup onto my cream carpet. How to remove, she asks. I mean, she's begging you. Any ideas?
Right. There is a recipe in here that I call Basic Magic. And it's a good grease buster. What it is basically is 50 grams of washing soda in a jug, pour over 200 mils of boiling water, stir it until it goes sort of a milky, cloudy colour,
yep.
Let it cool, add about 10 mils of eco-friendly washing up liquid, and what you get is a sort of thin syrup. And that is really, really good at dissolving grease and chocolate and things like that from carpets and upholstery. Again, cotton pad, dab at it, don't rub it, and you'll see that grease will lift off.
Okay, Rosie, I wish we had the baby's name, because sometimes it's good to name and shame, isn't it? but Rosie, I hope you were listening and you can pay attention to that advice there. You do mention in the book, Nancy, that there are certain things that you mustn't put down your sink, down the plug hole. And I must admit, I'd have to plead guilty to quite a few of them. Flour is one. Now, I'd never thought about that. What's the problem with flour?
Well, you see, I only found out that this was a problem because I created a problem in my own sink, which I talk about in here. I came in the kitchen, I had this lovely white gleaming sink. You looked down it, it was nice and shiny, but there was a smell. And it wasn't slow flowing, so the water was running away all right, but there was a smell. I went outside and I thought, well, it's not coming from outside, it's something in here. Mm. And I unveiled this chamber of horrors when I took the plug hole out to find it was thick, black, slimy, stinking awfulness. And what that was really was probably years of collection of debris that had got down the sink and got stuck just under the plug hole.
Right.
And so it's things like flour, bits of pasta, bits of rice, bread. I'm terrible for the breadboard, just, you know, if there's any crumbs, just slinging them into the sink. I put them in the bin now. But it's and all of these things sort of to congeal and then get thicker and thicker, and then what you have is a nasty mess under your sink.
Well, we don't want that. Rosie's come back in and identified the baby as Harry. Who is apparently the naughty child. That's right. Rosie saying that, not me.
No.
And Colin has got a fantastic, fantastic kind of end of days take. The moral of the story is don't have a cream carpet. And I'm with you there, Cole. Actually, don't. I mean,
do have a baby, though. If you
have
can.
A baby.
Yes.
Yeah. But
oh, yeah.
A cream carpet is just an absolute lifetime of tutting, isn't it?
It's an odd choice, I would say, at any time of life, a cream carpet.
Yeah. Nancy, what was your master's in?
Business administration. I got a master's in business administration. I used to work in management before I left to take up retirement, if that's what you call it.
Yeah. You've done well out of retirement, haven't you?
Do you ever have days when you yearn to be back in an office, Nancy?
Absolutely, 100% not.
No,
I realise it was not work, it was the job that was wrong for me, because I retired quite early at 52, and within 6 months I hated it, and I thought, it's not that I want to retire and just potter about and go for coffees and things. I don't want to do that. I like to be full on busy, and I am.
Yes, you are. You certainly are. What type of dog did you show at Crufts?
A Labrador. Which she thought she was actually a working sheepdog, because I went to a class that she was the only Labrador. All the others were working sheepdogs. So if she saw another working sheepdog, she was really, really pleased. If she saw another Labrador, just pass them by.
Okay. And so when you took her to Crufts, did you enter her in the working sheepdog category? Did anyone notice?
She was in the obedience section, so she was fine being a different breed.
Okay. Well, and did you win?
No, I didn't win. I realised that I couldn't rely. This dog had been so fantastic, and I'd taken her to a championship show, because to qualify for Crufts you have to accumulate so many points, so you have to go to different shows through the year. And she'd been to the Isle of Man championship show. The temperature was something like 32 degrees. It was a scorcher. And people were saying, keep your dog cool, you know, she won't be able to work in this heat. She cleared the board. She did all clear rounds. Brilliant. I qualified for Crufts. It was back in the day when it was in Earl's Court. I think it was 1989. And you had to leave your dog in a sitting position and then walk out of the ring for 5 minutes and then come back. And as I walked out of the ring, there were lots of other dogs, but I heard lots of laughing. And anyway, when I came back, all of the dogs were sitting there. My dog was laid on her back with legs in the air, full on, flat out, asleep.
Okay. Well, I'm with the dog. What was the dog called?
Meg.
Meg.
Oh, well done, Meg.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm channeling Meg. Nancy, it's always lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. Nancy Birtwistle's latest best-selling book is called Clean Magic, Essential New Tricks for a Sparkling Green Home. Get your chemicals out of your life.
Yes. Thank you, Nancy. She's one of those life-enhancing folk, isn't she? Happy in her work. Bestie says, 13 years ago, I entered my recently rescued Staffy Freddie into the dog show at the Village Summer Fete. Having been cooped up in Battersea Dogs Home for weeks, it was quite overwhelming for him. But he went on to win the rosette for the most handsome dog in the village. And he is still going strong. Remembering that day makes me feel ridiculously proud. So that's very touching, isn't it? And to Simon, who sent a slightly carpy WhatsApp, I just suggest you have a little look at the bestsellers, Simon, and maybe revisit your views on our guest. Okay?
It is 4:05. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. Join Hugo every Monday to Thursday morning from 10 as he takes a sometimes serious and sometimes satirical look at the day's news, politics and culture. Covering all the major stories making the headlines with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews. Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elavon.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Carol is a doctor. She was fit and healthy, so she couldn't possibly have a heart attack, could she? Turns out she could. Carol was driving home and started to experience chest pains. As they got worse, she recognised the symptoms. She pulled over and called 999. Carol was taken to A&E and transferred to the nearest cardiac unit for further assessment and treatment. Here, it was confirmed she'd had a heart attack. As a doctor, Carol knew what signs to look for and what treatment she might need, but her experience was still life-changing. But a healthy doctor who ended up being diagnosed with heart failure? It seems so unlikely. Unlikely, but not impossible. Carol survived her heart attack thanks to the help of scientific research, but still lives with heart failure. British Heart Foundation is funding research into gene therapies that could prevent, treat, and even reverse heart failure, helping more people like Carol. When you donate to British Heart Foundation, you're helping to fund life-saving research. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
This is Times Radio.
It's a very funny message from Helen, isn't it? Have you seen it?
Yes, you do it.
The Isle of Man links Meg's obedience trial, Fee's pastry and Jane's first fag. Who'd have thought? Well, Helen, it's not just my first fag. It was my only fag, which I happened to have on the Isle of Man. And you only know that, Helen, because you sound like a very dedicated listener to Off Air with Jane and Fee, which is what, Fee?
It's the podcast that will drop into your podcast box at about 6 o'clock every evening, where Jane and I chunter away through the day's news, through your emails and all kinds of things. And today on the podcast, we were considering whether or not it would be advisable to drink our own urine.
Yes, I can't remember why that came up. It was
neither
a while ago
now.
But you did, on the strength of that, make an extremely funny remark. So it's worth getting, yes, honestly, it's worth getting tonight's edition of Off Air with Jane and Fee for that. But if you missed any of Nancy Birtwistle's interview, that will be on the pod in its entirety, will it not?
It certainly will be. And you don't need to do anything other than tap on to the Times app, go to podcasts, and you can join in all the fun with us and many, many other podcasts available from the Times stable. The Story and the Royals and the Tech podcast are particularly good ones. Oh, yeah. And How to Win an Election.
They're all excellent. The Royals I've been certainly giving my ear, lending my ears to over the last couple of weeks. Although that story is slightly... Has it gone away?
No, it hasn't gone away. No, I think that's going to bubble up again.
All right. Have a very good late afternoon and evening, which I hope you will spend in the company of John Pienaar, who is next here on Times Radio. Our producer today was Liam Askin and our technical operator, Ryan Boyden. Have a good evening. John's next.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The Chancellor has been giving an update on the economy in her spring statement, saying the government has restored stability, and Britain's planning to send a warship to Cyprus to defend RAF Akrotiri from Iranian attacks. And coming up, the former director of the CIA, General David Petraeus, joins me live for an extended interview as we await President Trump's Oval Office news conference. And the Treasury Minister, Lucy Rigby, joins me to lay out the Chancellor Rachel Reeves' thoughts on the economy in the spring statement.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Stuart Winnie.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. In the spring statement, the Chancellor has insisted her government has strengthened the economy despite the OBR downgrading growth forecasts for this year. The budget watchdog has also warned the country's tax burden is to reach a record post-war high and that spending on welfare, including pensions, is to rise by a fifth before the end of this parliament. Rachel Reeves told the Commons she has the right economic plan for the country and has restored stability in an uncertain world.
Stability is the single most important precondition for economic growth. That is why we have committed to a single major fiscal event a year. limiting major policy changes to the budget and giving businesses and households the certainty that they need. Today, the new forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility show that our plan is the right one.
Britain is planning to send a warship to Cyprus to defend RAF Akrotiri from Iranian attacks. The Times has been told a destroyer with the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles could arrive in the region in a week. The US and Israel are striking targets in Iran for a fourth day. State media reports explosions in Tehran and Tabriz. Iran is threatening to fire on any ships attempting to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, an important route for moving oil. Brent crude has jumped in response to more than $84 a barrel, while UK wholesale gas prices have also surged. Professor Fawaz Gerges, a Middle East specialist at the London School of Economics, says things could get worse.
Now Israel has expanded the war into Lebanon. I expect the Houthis in Yemen to join the war any moment now. So what started as a simple and easy campaign to bring about regime change in Iran is really now escalating into a region-wide conflict with potential significant consequences on the world economy affecting Europe and the United Kingdom as well.
The European Union Asylum Agency is warning the Iran war could cause the biggest migration crisis in a generation. It said if even just 10% of the country's population moved, it could generate refugee movements of an unprecedented magnitude. It's released its annual report today, citing the country's turmoil as a major and long-term risk. Elsewhere, a judge says all trials of those charged with supporting Palestine Action have been put on hold. Chief Magistrate Paul Goldspring says cases will be reviewed again at the end of July. The government is challenging a High Court ruling that banning the group under the Terrorism Act was unlawful. An inquest in Sheffield has heard that a grandmother who died 4 months after contracting rabies on holiday was only diagnosed after a psychiatrist was called in. Yvonne Ford was scratched by a stray dog in Morocco, but was referred to mental health services as doctors struggled to assess her deteriorating symptoms. And the BAFTAs host, Alan Cumming, says people have been let down by broadcasting decisions made at the award show. A Tourette's campaigner involuntarily shouted a racial slur. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio, and thanks for your company. Tell me how this ends. That is the question that everyone's asking about the war in Iran. And yes, I know we're none of us fortune tellers. The fortune tellers listening in will just have to forgive me for saying that. But part of starting a war is supposed to be having some idea what it's meant to achieve. And so far, no one in the White House is being clear about that. Or rather, we're getting so many different answers that we end up none the wiser. We're going to cross live to the White House in Washington very shortly, where President Trump is about to speak at a news conference. Will he answer the big questions hanging over his decision to attack Iran 3 days ago? Can he? Now, though, I'm particularly glad to have with me, live on the line from Washington, D.C., the man who famously posed that question, tell me how this ends, when he was U.S. commander in Iraq. I'm talking about the former director of the CIA, General David Petraeus. General, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks.
Can you tell me, from all that we have seen and all that we've heard since the start of the Iran operation, can you see any clear answer to the question, your question, how does this end?
Well, I think the clear answer is that it depends. It depends on a number of different factors. I think it will certainly end with Iran's remaining nuclear components destroyed completely. I think that the regime forces will have been degraded very substantially. The missile stocks, launchers, and even manufacturing facilities will have been very heavily damaged, likely destroyed. Same for the drone facilities, although a more challenging target. Leadership, obviously, has already been heavily affected, the supreme leader and a number of other significant leaders. But the real question, of course, is will the regime still be standing, however battered and however damaged and degraded? And that's where I think it does depend. In particular, I think it depends on whether there is an element that emerges in opposition to the regime hardline elements, which essentially really the most important, of course, is the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, which has its own Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, established essentially for regime preservation for precisely this kind of situation.
Yeah.
And they have seemed to be quite coherent.
Yes.
Again, they will be heavily damaged. Their infrastructure is going to be destroyed in a number of places across the country. Then the question is, will the national police hang tough? Will the besieged militia, that's over 200,000 essentially street thugs, pipe swingers, willing to shoot at their own people, as they did together with the police during the demonstrations a couple of months ago, could the regular military, the so-called Artesh, could it emerge as an opponent for the hardline Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, their leadership, and perhaps for whomever is selected to be the supreme leader? As you know, probably the headlines at the Assembly of Experts was going to meet in the holy city of Qom, but that location apparently was attacked. But they presumably will figure out some place that is reasonably safe for them, well underground, where they can come together, their version of a conclave, and select the replacement to the supreme leader, who, of course, has been killed, Ayatollah Khamenei. In the meantime, there is a three-person body led by the president with the head of the judiciary and one cleric who has been selected, could have an inside track on being supreme leader. But it really comes down to what will happen on the ground inside Iran.
Yes.
Can there be a force that actually stands up? Because otherwise, John, the challenge with this situation, as in any similar to this, is that the element that prevails is